Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. In all my years of doing interviews, I met very few people who are as open and honest about themselves as my guest today, Dale Earnhardt Jr. Dale Jr. and I first met a little more than a year ago when I was doing a profile of him for ESPN the magazine. He had been NASCAR's most popular driver for more than a decade, but he was also coming off a series of concussions that had forced him out of his race car for more than half a season. The delicate state of Dale Jr.'s brain was matched by his natural anxiety. He's always worried about what other people think about him and if they see him for who he really is. That's natural, I guess, when you're the son of Dale Earnhardt Sr., the Intimidator, NASCAR's outlaw god, who died on the track at Daytona in 2001. Dale Jr. retired from NASCAR at the end of last season, although he still plans to enter a race now and then. Quickly took a job as a broadcaster with NBC. He'll be in the booth when NBC starts its slate of NASCAR races this summer. In the meantime, the network has already sent him to the Winter Olympics and to the Super Bowl. And at home, he and his wife Amy have a baby girl on the way. It's a time of transition for Dale Earnhardt Jr., and as always, he's thoughtful about it. I spoke to him recently at JR Motorsports, the race shop where he sponsors his own team of NASCAR drivers. Here's my conversation with Dale Earnhardt Jr. So Dale, I look at your Instagram every once in a while. I look up a couple of weeks ago and you're in South Korea.
Yeah.
So tell me a couple of things you did in South Korea that you've never done before.
A lot. I've just learned to ski over this new year, so I only have about 4 to 6 hours of skiing experience. We went to South Korea, not sure whether we'd get to ski or not, and as it turned out, the last full day we were there, a couple people wanted to go, so me and Mike Davis, we decided to go skiing, and aside from seeing the events, you know, if you just take the events off the table that we saw, the women hockey team winning gold, things like that, skiing in South Korea was incredible and so much fun. There weren't a lot of people skiing, so you had a lot of room. And I went down a black diamond, then I went down a double black diamond, and with only about 6 or 8 hours of experience total in skiing, I felt really good about myself. I didn't fall. I only fall when I'm standing still, like if I'm waiting on in line for to get onto the lift or something. Somehow or another, I find a way to fall. But when we're skiing, I've been real fortunate so far and haven't fell. And everything that we did was really a first. Going to the Olympics, you know, I've never been to the Olympics. Seeing those athletes compete. The whole trip was really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. South Korea was, you know, I don't know that I'd ever go there for any other purpose. And so I'm glad that my opportunity and my new job with NBC is taking me to these places, you know. So this is definitely getting out of my comfort zone.
Could you see, now that racing has become more of an international sport, could you see something put together where there could be some sort of car racing event in the Olympics?
I doubt it. You know, in NASCAR, we celebrate great drivers. Of course, you know, you have to have a great driver to win races, and we celebrate them for good reason. But we also celebrate the ingenuity of the team and engineers and the car, the mechanics and crew chiefs and the automobile itself. You know, we celebrate the car itself. And I don't know that the athlete or the driver separates himself enough from everything else it takes to win the race for it to be celebrated the way we do other Olympic sports. You know, when you see a guy come down the hill in an alpine event, no one talks about the skis he's on or the poles he's using, or nobody talks about the suit he has being more aerodynamic, or they don't talk about, they just say, you know, this guy's the best. And in racing, it involves so many other variables that I don't know that you can include it into the Olympics.
So now, you know, obviously for most of your adult life, you are on the track showing up every week as a driver. And now you're not. And now you're showing up at the track as spectator, race car, team owner in some of the series, and then later on this year as a broadcaster. So now you've gone back a few times. What's the stuff you miss, and what's the stuff you don't miss?
The stuff that I miss is usually really simple, you know, things that, I don't know. We were watching the Vegas race, and I miss running the high side at Vegas. I'd love to have been able to hop out there and run, you know, so 20 or 100 laps just around the high groove and had a little fun.
Right.
But I don't, you know, I don't miss trying to get through the bumps in turn one on the bottom, you know, and I appreciate how slick the track is and how it challenges drivers to try to get through the corners. We saw Jimmy Johnson getting into turn three underneath the car, turn sideways and kiss, you know, barely get into the apron a little bit, and just really an amazing save. And that right there helped you really understand just how slick the track is and how hard it is for these guys to get around there. I appreciate that, and I miss that challenge, but I don't actually miss the act of trying to do it, because it's really hard, you know, and frustrating. Like, driving race cars would bring out the worst in you from a personality and attitude standpoint, because driving a car is hard and it's frustrating most of the time. So a lot of times your attitude while you're doing that and in and around the car all weekend, it would reflect that frustration. And I talk about that a lot now. Life is so stress-free compared to where I was when I was a driver, and everything that I do now is so much more fun than it would have been had I been driving race cars. And going to the Super Bowl for NBC or going to South Korea, I would have been dreading it almost if I had a race to look forward to or think about. And
because the race would be in your head,
yeah,
even if you're doing something else.
Yeah. I couldn't never unplug from that completely and not think about it as all day, you know, even as I, any activity, vacation, whatever, I couldn't enjoy it to the fullest because I would always think about, man, you know, this Friday, I got to go to the track. We got to qualify. Man, we qualified like crap last week. I hope we qualify better. I should probably text Greg and see how he's going today. And, man, I hope we practice better. I remember where we ran good last time. I hope we can run good again there. You know, you just couldn't shut it off. And I'm not the kind of person that, like, sees the positives in everything or has this great disposition. I'm always sort of hoping for the best but preparing for the worst. And I noticed this when I got hurt in 2016 and I got out of the car and I didn't have to worry about going to the racetrack the next week. My doctor was like, you know, you need to get rid of all your anxiety. Don't even think about racing. Just go live your life. Forget about anything that's going to bug you. And so I did. I completely forgot about racing. I didn't even think about it or worry about it. And when I did that, I realized, wow, you know, this is what retirement's like. This is going to be, you know, when that happens, this is going to be a nice change of pace for me. And I don't have to worry about performance, living up to potential, my expectations, everyone else's expectations. I don't have to worry about every week trying to hit that target.
I remember you talking to me about that thing in particular, that worrying about how other people might judge you and then leaving, and that being sort of like how you judge yourself.
Yeah.
Have you felt like that's eased off?
It certainly has. Now that, I mean, I wanted to run well. If I'm going to go to the track, I want to run well. And I know that when I go race, the only race I got on the schedule this year is at Richmond in the fall in the Xfinity Series. And I know no matter how much I try to go into that just having fun, I'm going to get competitive. You want to get competitive.
Right.
And so all those old feelings of, man, I should run in the top five. You know, I should be able to run top five. That's a reasonable objective. I better meet that. If I don't, I'm going to be mad. I think everybody else should expect that. That's probably what they expect. I'm going to be mad that I didn't meet that goal for them, for me, whatever. You know, I'm going to put that pressure on me. I know I will. I don't have that pressure every single week no more. That's nice not to have that anymore. I do miss that in a weird way, that competition and that striving to be better at something or that needing to hit a target or but I think that as I get into broadcasting, I will find ways to find challenges in that and ways to measure my performance and expect more of myself and push myself. But it is nice to really kind of be free of all that performance pressure.
So when you are driving and retired drivers who are broadcasters would come around, did you guys treat those folks any differently, you know, than when they were active drivers? I guess what I'm getting to is, do you expect to be treated differently when you come back?
Sure. I don't know. I get real careful how I talk about drivers because I know as a driver, how touchy you are when people try to put words in your mouth or think for you. When I was a driver and a guy would retire, I had some envy of his of the time, the free time he had. And I still had a lot of respect for them, and I probably respected them more and appreciated them more as they moved on into the next chapter of their lives or whatever. I missed them because I probably didn't see them as much. And then there was a part of me that felt a bit like maybe they were just a little bit out of touch because they weren't in the car every week. And so trying to talk to them about what we're doing and what's happening every weekend in the cars wasn't as easy because they weren't in there. So there was a lot of emotions. I do expect to be treated a little bit differently. I think I have a lot of friends that I raced against, but there's a lot of guys that maybe when I wasn't great friends with, or a lot of guys there, you know, had a lot of guys that liked me, thought I was a good guy, and then there's a couple guys in there that don't like me or didn't think I was a good guy or thought I was full of shit, you know, or just never did understand my personality or who I was. So I don't know. I think that's going to be very interesting. Because I feel like I'm not sure about this, but I feel like to have a great opportunity and be a great broadcaster, I have to have great relationships with the drivers. And so for me to forget about how those relationships were when I was racing cars and start a new relationship with these drivers is going to be important. For me to let go of the ego and the pride and whatever disagreement or difference I have with a driver, for me to let go of that and start something new with them in relationship terms, to be able to go to them and talk to them and ask them questions and accept that information, you know, without bias is going to be important. So that's going to be a challenging deal for me because as a driver, you had grudges and people you didn't like and that was okay. And you just held them or, you know, you just, whatever you thought about a guy, it stayed that way. I can't have that as a broadcaster. I have to see all those guys out there as equals, and I can't have a poor opinion about one and a better, you know, bigger opinion of the other. It sort of has to be unbiased, I think, right?
Well, but it also feels like, you know, the broadcasters I respect the most are the people who have access and have good relationships.
Yeah.
But they're also willing to be honest about if somebody's not performing well or something.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody wrecks somebody and it's their fault.
Sure.
Or whatever. So have you thought about how to deal with that sort of thing?
Well, I don't think that you can't BS your way through those things. The fans are pretty good, especially in today's world of social media and so forth. The fans are really good. The court of public opinion has never been bigger and more of a loudspeaker and more prominent than today. And you can't get away with trying to sidestep something. You know, they'll call you out for not hitting the target and speaking on something that you see and everybody else sees, and it's apparent. You know, you just need to, I've been told time and time again that whatever you're going to say, you need to be able to say it to that person's face. And if you can't say it to their face, such as, I think that you wrecked that guy, mm-hmm. or whatever it may be, if you can't say it to their face, then you don't need to say it at all. And if it, and if you don't, and if whatever you say, you better believe in it.
So I know the ratings for Daytona were down this year, and there's been a several year sort of, you know, long-term mm-hmm. decline in ratings and things for NASCAR. Do you feel like the sport is kind of in trouble in any way? And if so, what are some things that you would do, you know, to, if you were in charge tomorrow, how would you change things?
I don't think the sport's in trouble. Obviously, they'd love to have, you know, great ratings. They'd love to have corporate sponsors spending $20 to $40 million on each team. And they'd love to have 50 cars showing up to every race. But NASCAR will always be around, no matter in what form. It'll always be around. We're not going out of business. Yeah, I think the numbers aren't great. I think everybody was surprised by the numbers for Daytona, and that sort of sets the tone for the, you know, the next several months at least. I hope that they can, you know, trend in the other direction. But for now, it's been very disappointing. But there's a lot of things that are a plus or a positive for the long term. We talk about the young guys coming in, and we've talked about that a lot this offseason. That doesn't fix it overnight. What, if any, effect that these young guys have on ratings and attendance and so forth won't be felt in the next several months. That'll happen over 2, 3, 4 years.
What about, I know it's hard to lay a lot of pressure on any one person or one driver. How important is Bubba Wallace to what's going to happen over the next few years of NASCAR? First black driver, full-time driver since Wendell Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know a lot of people are looking, wanting him to do well, yeah. obviously. Is that meaningful? And how, I guess the larger question is, how important is it for NASCAR to sort of broaden its fan base in that sense?
Yeah, I think that NASCAR certainly needs to do everything it can to make itself appealing for everyone, you know, and Bubba can have a hand in that. I think it's a lot of pressure and expectation to put on Bubba as one person. If there were more than one black driver in the sport, then that, you know, that'd be a good responsibility for several of them to share. But we don't have but one. And so that's a lot to put on just Bubba to, you know, and he just want, you know, he needs to worry about going out and competing and running well. It's just a lot to expect him to carry additional responsibility.
Yeah.
I think if he does go out there, and my advice to him so far has been to, you know, concentrate on your performance and also concentrate on your branding of yourself and how you represent yourself. Think about the things you're doing today. Think about the things you're doing today and what that's going to feel like 10 years from now when you look back on it. Are you going to be proud of that? Are you going to be wishing you'd done that differently or handled that differently? That's really hard to do at a young age, but he had more media responsibility and pressure than anyone has ever had in the sport during the speed weeks of Daytona. I think he did a great job. He came out of there looking great, finished well, handled himself well in front of the media. Anybody else, I think, or a lot of guys under that same pressure and responsibility and daily, you know, focus. I mean, he had cameras on him all the time, even in his private moments. He couldn't escape it. And he had signed up for that. You know, he signed up to be filmed and recorded pretty much 24 hours a day. Anyone else would have had a lot of moments where they snapped or got short with it or got fed up or got tired of it or needed a break, and he never did that. You know, there were times I think when he was running out of patience, but he held it together. You know, I think that you know, what he's already, you know, had an incredible impact. He's already shined a great light on NASCAR and opened up the sport to a whole new audience. And I think that he'll continue to make progress as the year goes on. But we need more than one black driver in the sport to really see a huge change.
This is not apples to apples, yeah. Obviously, but when you came along, you came sort of pre-burdened with expectations because of your dad, and you were bringing in a different demographic, maybe younger fans of NASCAR. I mean, do you see parallels, and did you see mistakes you made back then that you were telling Bubba, don't do this, basically?
No, I don't know if I was I called Bubba a time or two and just wanted to offer support. I didn't want to get too deep in the weeds and with information that he didn't need, you know.
Right.
I just would say to Bubba, and I would say it to him today, is I'm here. I believe in you. I support you. Know that you have people behind you that care about you and support you. And in those moments when you feel like you're, you know, you just really want a vacation, you know, just take a deep breath and think about how many people really care about you and want to see you do well.
Now, were you able to think about that when you were?
It would have helped to have heard that a lot more than I did. I think that those moments. What has always been good for me is for someone to cheerlead a little bit. You know, I never responded well to my dad's brand of criticism and his brand. He was basically. He would come in and say, you need to show more initiative, you know. And, boy, if you hear that every single day, that gets pretty damn old. I knew what he wanted me to hear, but his delivery was awful. And I think that what I responded well to was, we're not right. We're not perfect today, but we're going to fix it, and I'm going to help you fix it. And we're going to get it right. And that reinforcement, that positive reinforcement always worked really well for me. This might not be what we're looking for, but tomorrow we're going to get there. That was nice to hear. And that gave me confidence, you know, that things were going to get better. So I think what I like to say to any young driver, I tell them the reason why I talk to them is because I believe in them. And I believe when the opportunity presents itself, that they're going to excel. And I don't know. I think it helps people to hear or know that they got people in their corner. So looking back on my experience coming into the Cup Series, the countdown to E-Day and all that stuff, all those things were big, manufactured by my sponsor, Budweiser. They were creative. They were smart. It was amazing. It blew me up. And raised my profile and my awareness. And I didn't understand all those things back then. I didn't know that was even important. I just was like, wow, this is a lot. I don't want all this. Sometimes hype and people's excitement for something like a Bubba Wallace or me coming into the sport. Sometimes that feels like expectation where it is, man, I'm excited to see you. Becomes, man, I hope you run good today, you know.
Yeah, you better win.
You better win.
Yeah.
That's what you hear as a driver. And so I think, you know, just making sure that Bubba knew, hey, everybody just look happy about this. Don't feel like that this means you got to go win the Daytona 500 this weekend. Just this is all excitement for you. We're happy that you're here and we're happy, you know, everybody's happy that this is happening. You know, just celebrate. We're celebrating you, you know. And not to feel this pressure like, man, now I gotta, it ain't good enough unless I win. That's not realistic.
When we come back, Dale Earnhardt Jr. talks about his dad as a parent and the kind of parent that he wants to be. That and much more ahead on this episode of Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.org. www.skiingandsailing.com. Hey, Southbound fans. Whether you're an active fan of Tommy Tomlinson or an active listener of WFAE, we have the best way for you to become an active supporter. Southbound t-shirts are now available for purchase with a $17 a month sustaining gift to WFAE. The shirt's new, it's soft, and it's a great conversation starter, just like this podcast. So grab a Southbound shirt today by hitting the donate button on WFAE.org. Thanks. Now, let's get back to the show.
I want to go back to something you said about, you know, the way that what your dad said sort of landed on you, and how you kind of knew what he was saying, but the delivery wasn't great. So you're about to be a dad.
Yeah.
When's Amy due now?
May the 2nd.
So a couple months off. So as you've thought about being a dad, have you thought about the things that your dad did that you liked and enjoyed and want to continue with your child or children, as it may be, and the things you'd like to do differently?
Well, I definitely, she's not going to probably ever see me race. So I don't know if she'll have any connection to what I did as a race car driver.
You have to show old DVDs or something.
And right? She might not even care, right, you know, to see all that. That information will always be there if she really wants to dig into it. I'm not going to go out of my way to take her back into that, you know, that whole experience. I will probably be more excited about what she wants to do if it's unrelated to racing, because that'll be as interesting and new to me as it will be to her. If she wants to get into racing, I mean, I will want to help her and want to support that for sure. But I know how difficult that is, not only being a woman, but being an Earnhardt. That's like two strikes. That's just going to make it really challenging for her. So I definitely won't be trying to, you know, guide her in that direction with, you know, little go-karts and all kinds of things in her youth, trying to get her excited about it.
Do you feel like your dad did that?
No. My dad did not. I don't know how to say this without making it sound like he didn't care, but up until I was about 10 or 11 years old, he did nothing. You know, he did nothing in those first 10 years to introduce me to what he was doing, other than take me with him. And I had to beg to go to the shop. I would beg to go to Mamaw's house where his Sportsman or Xfinity shop was. And I was in the shop some, but mostly it was to play with the other kids in the neighborhood. He did nothing to, you know, there was no go-kart in the yard. I got a go-kart at 12 years old. That was kind of young back then, you know. Guys weren't putting their sons in carts at 5 years old like they're doing today. But even with that, he didn't spend any time with me really showing me what I was doing. I think he went to the go-kart track with me in my first race. I don't think he saw another race after that. He never saw any of my late model races. I ran 159 late model races, and to my knowledge, he never saw one of them. He was like, you know, I got a lot of shit going on. I got a lot of stuff happening. I don't have time to hold your hand here. If you like, you know, want to try street stock racing, here's an article in the Char Observer. They're starting a series. Read up about it. You and your brother go figure it out. That was it. We read the article. We went and bought a car, me and my brother. We built the motor, and we took it to the racetrack. Dad did weld the cage in because he insisted to do it because he knew we would weld it in there and it'd pop right out. But he didn't go and turn a bolt on the car. You know, he wasn't like, hey, you know, is it loose? Is it tight? He wasn't like that, you know. I watched Steve Letarte with his son. He's in there working with his little, you know, go-kart and setting it up and helping him race and going to all the races every week. Dad was more like, I'll try to provide what I can, but you got to take it there. You got to take it and use it, you know. He didn't have time to go invest personal time in it.
So how do you see yourself as a dad? You see,
I don't know. I really don't know. I think that with, I think being this old, I'm 43. I say being this old. I think being retired from driving and out of that circle, that cycle of going all the time and traveling so much. I mean, I know I'm going to be going to broadcast races, but being a driver, I think, and raising a child would have been different, not quite as easy. And so with driving out of the way, for lack of a better way to say it, I think that I'll be able to be a little more hands-on. And if I do want to get involved in what she's doing, I mean, I watch, and she's being a girl, you know, I'm going to probably be a whole lot more hands-on with her than I would be if my son, you know, if I have a son one day, I'll probably be a lot more like my dad as far as like, you know, here's the golf club, you figure out how to swing it, you know? And I'll stand back and watch and tell you whether you're doing it right or not.
Right.
But with my daughter, I'll be a little more, you know, I'll help her a little bit more, I think. Because with sons, you just try to, you're so hard, you know, on them because you expect them to be automatic. You expect them just to figure it out.
Right. Well, I wonder, though, if, you know, maybe it's better to treat the son more like you might treat the daughter.
Maybe.
And vice versa.
I don't know. I'm really going to take my lead from Amy as far as what she expects out of me. I know what I'm going to feel emotionally and how I'll feel a certain way and I'll want to. But I'm going to also listen to my wife as far as how she wants me to react in certain situations and whether she thinks I need to get in there a little further and be more involved or not.
Yeah.
We got to do this as a team.
You know, you used to talk about, have talked with me about sort of borrowing trouble and sort of pre-worrying about things before they happen. Has this happened with you as parenting? Are you anxious about it? Are you excited about it?
I'm all that. I can't wait to change diapers and be, you know, get in there and do.
Oh, you say that now.
I'm really feeling that way. I've already changed diapers on my friends' kids. You know, it doesn't bother me. I like that. I like the idea of being a father and doing those things, you know, and it's nothing for me to change Wyatt's diaper, my nephew or whatever, you know. I wouldn't think anything of it. Something needs to be done. I know some of my friends didn't want to do that or weren't interested in getting up in the middle of the night and taking care of those things. But I feel like that I'm going to want to do those things and I'm going to want to be involved. And for me to have a connection to my daughter, I think it'd be good for me to be doing those things, for her to see me as a provider and somebody who's active in her life and doing things for her. And early on, I think will really help our relationship and our connection. But, you know, when we first got pregnant, I was excited and I wanted to go ahead and get to work on the nursery and boy, you know, I was just ready to go. And Amy is like, you know, let's wait. Why do we got to? We don't have to do that right now. And I'm like, well, you're not going to be comfortable at 7, 8, 9 months. And you're not going to want to try to design a nursery and order furniture and whatever, you know, these things in this last part of your pregnancy. Not that I have any experience with that, but I'm just thinking, you know, wouldn't you want to do it now while you feel, you know, like you can move about a much easier? But she's so I was a little anxious and anticipating a little bit too much. And so I learned a lot of things in this experience. And one of the most important things that I learned is to communicate with Amy as much as I can about how she feels about certain things instead of trying to take the lead on it. She'll tell me when it's time to start designing the nursery or ordering things. And she'll ask me what I think about this and that and the other, and when she needs that information. And
I saw you caught some grief recently for eating the last of the ice cream in the house.
I did. She
were you headed out of town or something?
No, I just was up in the middle of the night and was looking for something to eat. It was thin pickings in there. And there was like a little bit of a, there was like a half a bucket of a little cut, one serving ice cream. There was about a half of that left, and I thought, man. But just as I did it, she wanted ice cream as soon as it was. That's my luck. But it's been a good experience. I've learned a lot about us working together and us being a team. And I mean, you think that, you know, we got married and we've, you know, as you spend so much time with this person and you feel like that you're really working together well, you know, going through this pregnancy has exposed where we aren't as strong as we might have thought, and it's made those places stronger. And you're like, wow, I didn't know that we could work so well together. I thought we would always, I thought this was your personality and this was mine, and we would always sort of have to, you know, bend and flex with how we got along. But we get better and better at working together and thinking the same, and it makes everything a lot easier as we do that. But
I know you talked a lot about how she helped you when you were recovering from your concussions and all.
Yeah.
So are you done with that treatment now? Do you still go see a doctor about that? Where are you?
I don't go. I'm done. I got clear. Well, when I say I got clear, basically you sort of graduate, I think. And, you know, the doctor will tell you, he's like, I don't think I need to see anymore. And as long as everything's good, if you got any questions, give me a call. I got Dr. Mickey Collins is my doctor in Pittsburgh. And I can call him any day, and I do. I call him sometimes, and if I have questions or something comes up, or
so. Do you ever feel anything that feels like this might be a symptom or something like that?
Well, so I'm still really kind of weeding through that, and what I mean is, before you ever have any problems with your body, you don't have any knowledge about concussions, you're oblivious to even thinking about it. You don't even, it never crosses your mind, right? Well, when you get hurt and you have sickness and illness, and we call it sickness and illness, but when you have these symptoms, man, you're starting to feel your sensors and senses that you never even thought to take notice of. You start to analyze yourself far more than you should. You start to understand and learn and gain knowledge about concussions and injuries and head injuries and how the brain works. You don't really need to know that stuff, you know. With, you know, if you haven't had a head injury, you don't know it. You don't even think about it. So when you go through all that and absorb all that information and turn on all those sensors, you can't turn it off. It's like in racing, all the engineering and technology that we've learned, we can't unlearn it. It's here to stay. And so when I go around my day-to-day life, I feel things and sense things that I would never even have noticed before. And I don't know whether I just sense them because I've become so self-aware and overanalyzing myself every day. I don't know whether it's a real symptom or it's just something that I've learned to take note of and I can't forget.
So it could have been something that's been happening for years.
Yes.
But you just now that started noticing.
Right. So, and my doctor calls it putting things in a concussion bin, and that's a bad habit. So if you forgot where you put your keys or what you did with your phone, my wife forgets where she put her phone at least once every day sometime during the day, right? And it'll be over there on the table, or it'll be upstairs at her makeup table, whatever. And I probably do the same thing with my phone. But now that I've had this concussion, every time I forget where my phone is, I wonder if it's a sign of a problem. My doctor says you're putting that in the concussion. Everything you think that is a problem, you're putting in a concussion bin, and you got to stop that. That's just regular life. If you had a symptom of forgetting things from a concussion, then every time you forget something for the rest of your life, you're going to think, that's because I've had a concussion. When maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just something normal that was always there, that's going to be there the rest of your life. So the problem is that if you've had a lot of different symptoms, then there's a lot of things that you're going to always think about and acknowledge and analyze every single day. I had a lot of symptoms with my eyes. And so I find myself every day sort of testing myself if my eyes are working right. and it drives me bonkers. There'll be days when I wake up and things are a little blurry, and I think, man, is this just me, and I'm going to have these problems the rest of my life? And it turns out that I just needed to give myself an hour to get woke up, and my vision improves. I can't say for sure, like, hell yeah, I have symptoms every day, but when you go through that experience and you have to analyze yourself when you're ill, you keep on analyzing yourself even when you're well, and you always will. And those things that you learned about your concussion and trying to recover from it, you can't unlearn. You can't turn off all that.
So I think when we talked a year or so ago, you had just sort of kind of opened up publicly about all that. And you were starting to hear from people who wanted to know what your experience is like, because they'd had similar ones. Mm-hmm. They want to know about your doctors and that sort of thing. Have you continued to hear from people and get their stories too?
Only really online. Actually, that's not true. I ran into a guy when I was at Daytona. This is a great experience for me. I walked into a guy in the middle of the garage, and he walked up to me, had his brother with him and his dad. And the younger boy was like, I read about your story. I was having all these problems and had been in an accident of some sort, and I'd had all these problems and couldn't figure out what to do. And I'd been to all these doctors, and I finally went to Pittsburgh at the United Medical Center. And I got help from Mickey, my doctor. Oh. And he said, I finally, got well, and I just got cleared in January. And here we are in February in Daytona. And he's like, I just got cleared last month, man. And it's awesome. I'm so happy. And I've been dealing with this and couldn't get in front of the right doctor. And I finally got in front of Mickey, and he fixed it. And so we cheered and laughed about Mickey for a minute, because Mickey's does amazing things, and he's a freaking miracle worker. And then we exchanged contacts so we could stay in touch and maybe see each other again somewhere along the racing circuit. I hear from people on social media from time to time asking me either questions about, hey, did you experience this, or where did you go, or they're over whatever issues they had, and they just want to share that they understand the challenges or the struggle with it. But yeah, I still hear from people, which is great, and I'll never understate my issues or my experience. I don't want people to think of me of, well, that's that guy that had that concussion, and man, that's concussion guy. But I also want to help people, and I want to be involved in that conversation, and I keep my ear to the ground. I follow a lot of different handles on social media to stay abreast of the latest and greatest conversations and research and so forth. And I want to always kind of be aware of where we are in studying concussions and in trying to treat them. I also like to stay in touch with Mickey because I like to work with him directly if he needs me to go speak or be a part of a conversation anywhere. I feel like I owe him so much for being able to put me back together and bring me out of the fog I was in. So I love to be connected to him. And anytime anybody ever asks me to get involved in anything, if it's research or rehabilitation, or if it's a hospital over here or a doctor over there, I always call Mickey. And I always say, Mickey, this person's asking me to be involved in this. What do you think? And I don't do anything unless he gives me sort of his approval on it, because I don't want to ever do anything that's going to misalign me with his approach and his beliefs. And I always kind of want to be tied to him because I feel safe. If I ever need him again, I want to know he's right there.
Right.
I love being able to explain to people how to get help. Want them to feel less helpless about the situation than they feel, and positive about a possible brighter future. It's a scary, scary place to be, when you're not well and you don't think you're going to get well, and you've seen, four or five guys that haven't been able to help you. So yeah. Scary, you think, man, this is my life. This is it. This is where I'm going to be the rest of my life. I have to live with this. That is so scary. And so I love being able to point people in the right direction to Mickey, and I know that anybody I send over there, he's going to fix it. I know it. And so it's awesome to hear those people talk about their experiences once they do get in front of that guy.
I want to bring all this back around to one last thing.
Sure.
You talked about, you know, we've talked before, that when you were being treated for the concussion and you were recovering, that you felt like the person you were then,
oh yeah,
was sort of the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
That you were kinder, you listened more, paid attention to other people, all those sorts of things. Now that you're clear of that some, it's been a year or two, mm-hmm. how much of that person that you always wanted to be do you feel like you've retained?
I feel like I've retained quite a bit of it, to be honest with you. I have a whole lot more patience than I had before, and that patience and my ability to, I don't know how to explain it perfectly, but I was really impatient, very short, easily frustrated, and I don't feel like that I have those days anymore. I don't feel like that I have that response to people anymore. I feel like that I'm a lot more flexible and a lot more understanding and a lot more forgiving and hopefully more pleasant to be around. I think a lot of that was going through the concussion and understanding how I had become that person. I think a lot of it was shedding away the layers of what racing was doing to me as a person. And it's my fault. It's not racing's fault. It's like my inability to handle, you know, what I was going through as a person. So I think being ripped away from that, and having to go through the rehabilitation and all that in the concussion situation, I think it allowed me to see the error of my ways, you know, and make some adjustments. And so I'm glad that there was some positives to pull out of that experience, being out of the car. And that could have went so terribly wrong and been a very black time for me and a very dark time that I might be still stuck in. But it allowed me to get out of that stress and say, man, I wasn't handling that well at all. And I was not good to people that care about me. You know, I wasn't pleasant, and I was unpleasant there was no better way to explain it. I wasn't fun to be around. And I feel like that now I'm a lot more easygoing. And like, I find myself in scenarios and situations, going into Super Bowl and going to South Korea would be two good examples. I found myself in scenarios and situations during those two experiences where the old me would have been anxiety ridden and would have been short and snappy and in a poor mood at certain points in the day, and frustrated and not enjoying what he was seeing or experiencing when he should have been freaking having a great time. And I go through those experiences now, and I have no disruptions. I have no frustrations. I feel like that the people that are with me in those moments are not suffering from my personality, or I'm not making the situation unbearable. And I know that sounds crazy, I bet, but that's how it was. That's how things were for me. Me and Mike Davis have been working together for a very, very long time, and I always look at our relationship and how we work together and how we get along as sort of a good benchmark for where I am as an individual. He's such an – everybody loves Mike. Everybody gets along with Mike. If I can be around him and have a great experience – I think that I've made some good changes, and if I get around him and don't have a great experience and I make the experience bad for him, then I know that I'm not handling the situation the way I should. And when we worked together, when he was on the road with me, I think back to those times, and I think back to our arguments and disagreements, and I think back to that being a lot of my responsibility and how difficult I was to be around and work with. And so when we go to South Korea together and we spend a whole week together over there and never have one disagreement, never have one negative word toward each other, or not even a hint of a disappointment or unhappiness. I think that that says a lot about where I am today as a person. And I think it says a lot about some of the changes that I've made and the efforts that I've made to be a better person, to be a funner person to be around. And it's not as, it's gotten easier. You know, I think those changes would have been hard to make if I was still driving race cars. Cause, race cars just, I mean, I don't know how to, I don't want people to think that I hated driving cars cause I loved it. And I'd still be driving cars if I hadn't got hurt, you know, but it did make me a miserable person. You know, it made me a less, happier person cause I wanted to do so well. And there's a lot more downs, even for the guys that are doing, even for guys like Jimmy and Kyle that are so successful, even for those guys that win so much, there's still more downs than there are ups. There's more frustrations and disappointments in that job. And I didn't handle those well. You know, I didn't handle that pressure as well as I should have. To be out from under that, I think, is allowing me to have a better perspective and a better, every day's a little bit easier and lighter.
Well, you sure have been patient with us, Dale. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so
much,
man.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
So Dale Jr. and I did this interview in his own podcast studio. He and his people have a whole series of podcasts on what they call Dirty Mo Radio. Dirty Mo being their nickname for Mooresville, where the studio is located. The studio's in the JR Motorsports gift shop, and it's basically a big glass booth. Anyone who's in the gift shop can see inside. So while we were setting up for the interview, a family came in and walked around in the gift shop, and all of a sudden they saw Dale Jr. sitting there in the booth. Dale Jr. didn't see him at first. He was looking at his phone. But then he looked up and he saw them staring at him through the glass. It must have been like being in a fishbowl. So Dale Jr. hopped up and he said, "Let me take care of this for a second." He went out, he shook hands with the family, he talked to them, he gave them a little bit of his time. He spent the most time with a little boy in the family. One of the things they sell in the gift shop are used lug nuts from the wheels of the race cars. The little boy bought one and he looked up at Dale Jr. and he said, "Would you sign my lug nut?" There's not a whole lot of autograph space on a lug nut. Dale Jr. did the best he could. In those couple of minutes, I got just a glimpse of what it must be like to be really famous, to be stared at through the glass. And I also got a sense of what it's like to handle that moment with grace. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanel. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch, and our theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or picks for your all-time favorite driver, email me at tomlinsonwrites@gmail.com. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on WFAE.org, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Also, between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour, with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. You can find those on WFAE.org's Southbound page. See y'all next time. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.